The honor to be giving this talk at Jikoji. This is a way-seeking mind talk, which is the first talk that anyone would give in this kind of a setting, a Zen center. So I wanted to talk about a couple of things. No mind would seek the way without substantial obstacles on the way, obstacles that we don't know what to do with. So I want to talk about that. And then the second point would be, what do we do after overcoming these obstacles? So for all of us here on this path, I'm sure it kind of can be summed up by this quote from Wendell Berry, and this is related to my first point of what to do with the obstacle. And the quote is this: when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And when we no longer know which way to go, we have begun our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. So I use a little bit of my own story to share this. First of all, I wanted to mention that, like many people here, I'm not really used to telling my story, and I don't really like to hear myself talk about myself, especially, which is, I think, partly why some of you guys are here, because I'm not the most talkative person at all. However, I've come to learn that from the kindness of many people that my story has value. And it's not necessarily a personal story, but it's a story that, you know, each life has its place, and we have all learned on this journey. So I wanted to share some of it. And it's interesting or serendipitous that I'm giving this talk on this particular weekend, because yesterday, 23 years ago, I first came to the United States, which is a very significant date for me. Certainly that, you know, ever since then, my life has changed completely. I went to West Valley College just down the hill for almost 4 years, learned English, and never knew Jikoji was here. And if I did, my life would have been quite different from you know, this as well. So it's kind of interesting to think about that, how close I've come to this, yet it wasn't yet my path then. So as an immigrant, I've certainly had the English-seeking mind, the home-seeking mind, the identity-seeking mind, but I want to go a little bit more, you know, much earlier in my life to talk about the way-seeking mind. So I'll talk a little bit about my growing up in China. So it's a very different time and place, and the context is entirely different. And sometimes it's hard for me to share it because it's not necessarily, even for me, I get a sense of vertigo thinking about it because everything is different. It's hard to get a sense of the difference, but I'll describe it a little bit. And you know, compared to coming here as someone, we call it FOB, fresh off the boat, and you know, I sometimes feel like I've lived several lives, especially compared to the first village that I was born in northeast China, which is called Manchuria, as cold as North Korea or Siberia, and it's a small village that my parents were sent to do physical labor during the Cultural Revolution, away from universities and the big cities and so on. So they bought the first 9-inch black and white television and the first bicycle in the village. So it was the center of living can probably be compared to Victorian times in America. So sometimes, you know, if we talk about time can be measured by change, I feel like I'm 100 years old, you know? I've seen so much massive change, so I also have a sense of what stays unchanging. So life can be very hard, and but for a child, you know, a very young child do not know what hardship is. So I have rather fond memories of just the spring, you know, what the, you know, streams after a hard frost, you know, feels like, the sparkles on the water. But when I was about 4 and a half, we moved down south. Cultural Revolution ended. We moved back down south to a city, and I grew up then within a university environment where my parents were doing research. And so the living conditions improved quite a bit. And my parents were kind of a couple that others envied, for they had great potential. However, as our living conditions improved, I think in some ways the clinging that comes from hope in life, also increased, which increased suffering. So I saw that their intellect. These are my partners in crime, the cooks. thank you. So with the living conditions improving, the suffering also increased in the family. So I saw that their intellect was actually no match for the so-called petty problems of life. You know, who does the chores and how do you get these opportunities that are kind of way off there and yet feels like it should be theirs. So at times these potentials make fools of them. So at a young age, I realized that I wanted to be wise rather than smart. In the thick and tense air at home, there was no space for my sense of self, for my soul. And since I was powerless to change that situation, I found solace in the little bits of nature around the university campus. And you know, these are no match for like the beauty of the Stanford campus and so on around here, or even West Valley College. But still, I would stop in my tracks when I remember the morning glories and in the morning walks to school, and the green grass and these purple blue morning glories that is brilliant like the night sky. Or when I was a little bit older, walking to school a slightly longer distance, the sycamore maples and being backlit by the streetlight. Or there was some lotus flowers in a pond in the Chinese university, you know, Chinese garden style, and how the water drops would move around the lotus leaves like, you know, mercury, balls of mercury. Brilliant. And so these were, I felt like they were the most glorious things I have ever seen. And they were meaningful to me. So in that sense, I realized something that I didn't have words for until almost 20 years later, which is that beauty and meaning are the same thing, exactly. And because I saw beauty, it meant to me that my life was meaningful. And I can also see that the beauty was everywhere around me, everywhere that I cared to look. And so even though that it seemed like no one else around me was noticing it, my life had a sense of grace. So in the Zen sense, I see now from reading Dogen that I was losing myself, and in that process being affirmed by all things. Later, more recent years, I had a lot of thoughts about, you know, why these things occur to me, why beauty and meaning are so important to me. And I realized there are many synonyms to these things. And I like to play with language, so this may not be so tidy in a sort of philosophical sense, but I wanted to mention this. So synonyms to beauty and meaning may include things such as stillness, silence, emptiness, eternity. And this could be one group of synonyms. And the other group could be things like love, energy, action. And these two are essentially yin and yang in life, logos and eros. So, and these are the two wings that life flies on, and these are the two wings that have carried me. I decided to come to the United States after the Tiananmen incident in 1989. I realized that even though I was still very young, I realized I wouldn't have real freedom in China. So after numerous rejections of visa, you know, with American consulate, eventually I was actually granted a visiting visa. And so I came to the U.S. fresh off the boat. And luckily the U.S. is really amazing place for a young person in terms of the resources, the nearly free resources that can be given, and the opportunities that one has here to learn and to work and you know, to become something. So I went to West Valley College, as I mentioned, and then worked in the Bay Area and went to school at UC Davis. And eventually I went to San Francisco Zen Center for a couple of talks and kept going. And then that led to other interests in Buddhism and reading. And I went on a couple of retreats. And then I traveled the world, which was also very meaningful for me in the sense that external and internal exploration for me went hand in hand. I realized also, like, before such a big journey, you know, people have a lot of warnings and so on, but I realized that I don't have to be ready. I just have to do it. You know, if you waited until you were ready for life, then it would never happen. So, and from that, you know, more magic happened. I came to know Native American spirituality quite a bit also. And there, I was amazed there is such a basically an exotic culture, you know, right here in our backyard. And I was honored to be a part of it. And I was very inspired by the generosity and the joy of the people who was on that path. So there were a lot of grace doing this journey, and the sense of beauty and magic never left me. I learned to be grateful for everything, and that means everything. So there were many times when I really didn't know what to do about something, about some really tough obstacles, an impasse. One important teaching came in the form of a quote from Viktor Frankl, which is, when we're no longer able to change a situation, we're challenged to change ourselves. There's another, there's a book called Nothing Changes Until You Do, which I think sum up life pretty well. So for most of my life, and I think this is very, very Asian, I've carried the idea that life is hard. You know, I think for many cultures that have a very intimate relationship with hardship, there's this feeling that you know, working hard is part of life. And how do you know that you are getting something out of life if you're not suffering in some way, right? If you're not contributing so much that you're not enjoying yourself. So working hard can actually be the easy part, right, in some way. So I think only in recent years that I actually felt that life can be easy. And this is really a sea change for me. And so challengers are no longer really challenges. So I do feel in some way I am sort of post-suffering, post-hardship, even though there's so much more to go. When I'm hiking these surrounding woods or Portola Redwood State Park, I have this feeling that all these trees, you know, all of them have been through a lot of trauma. If you look at them, you know, there are these, you know, bulbous growths, or they are bent in crazy ways with other trees or rocks or snowfall. And if you, you know, I was looking around at these trees and there's one that's perfectly straight and tall. And then I look up and the top is like this, right? It's been hit by lightning or something like that. So we all have our stories, right? And no life that's truly lived is smooth. Yet the obstacles is what makes the stream sing. And if you look at those trees, they all have their undeniable beauty, you know, brought on by the challenges, the suffering that had been its path. And in very understated ways, life has been teaching me patience. I now know that more than 20 years is actually a perfectly fine amount of time to wait. And an impasse might come to pass in 20, 30, 40 years, and that is okay. You know, there's a sense of perspective that I didn't have when I was younger, because new bridges are continually being built by love, essentially. New possibilities emerge. So I want to go to my second point, which is, what do you do after inevitable challenge? What do you do with a gift of healing? And I think often we have the experience of, after a big challenge, there's a bit of dip in mood, because the feeling is, now what? So what? Right? Now what do I live for? So I want to share with you another quote, which is, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and then go and do that, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. So I feel like a baby sometimes, literally, unsure of what is peering behind these eyes. I've always been curious and interested in a great deal, but now there's an embodied quality to life that I didn't have when I was young. I feel connected to people, connected to love, to happiness, but also to pain, to suffering, that of my own and that of others. And with this comes a pervasive sense of tenderness. And sometimes we question if we are doing good or if we are good. And I want to share that this is a quote probably from Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, that we're not happy because we're good, but rather that we're good because we're happy. So I've come to trust my spontaneous goodness, you know. And I think that is helpful in so many situations, to just trust that good things will come if I'm here, if I'm truly here. So I've spent more time talking about the first point, which is what do we do with the obstacle, but I want to impress on you the second point, which is do what makes you feel alive, do what makes you feel happy. And because, you know, which for me, it can be looking at the trees, you know, looking at how the sun makes the leaves dance, those little things, these diamonds, right? And they're everywhere. And that's exactly what we're to do with this gift of life, the gift of healing. The way-seeking mind, I've heard translated also as bodhicitta. So this is a bodhicitta talk. Bodhicitta is more commonly translated as awakened heart. So I want to draw the connection that in some ways the way-seeking mind is already awakened, and the mind is also not different from the heart. In some way, they can be different, but also it is the same. And thus is the paradox of so much of life. I want to share with you something that I feel sums up the challenges as well as the motivation to get to the other side of these challenges. And this is a quote from Nisargadatta Maharaj, which is an Indian non-dual teacher. A question was asked of him, in the inclusive mind, is the problem of joy and sorrow, does that problem exist no longer? And he said, not as we know them, as desirable or repugnant. It becomes rather a question of love seeking expression and meeting with obstacles. The inclusive mind is love in action, battling against circumstances, ultimately victorious. And for me, that was interesting because in Zen, we don't really talk about battles. But I felt that's true in so many ways. But why do we need these battles? And what is that? What is that? Why is that so much part of life? But I can indeed feel this, that loving action is always going to be met with obstacles, but that is part of the expression of love. Yet ultimately, it is always victorious. Another question was asked of the Maharaj, between the spirit and the body, is it love that provides the bridge? And he said, what else? Mind creates abyss, the heart crosses it. And what I mentioned of the mind and heart are not the same thing. Yet one side can create the abyss, but the other side will cross it. Yet all along, they're actually the same. So I really want to leave a lot of time for questions. So I will stop here. And I want to say I'm really a toddler in this journey. So thank you. Jana.
Jenna, please.
I just wanted to say to you, particularly for that little phrase you used, that it's the boulders that makes the stream sing.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That's just mm-hmm. wonderful.
Thank you. That was very helpful for me as well.
I was wondering if you, personal history-wise,
yeah.
if you could sort of say a little bit more about what's going on right now with your life? I mean, your work and
sure.
your personal life? Just
thank you.
Whatever. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Sure. So clearly I don't share much of myself, even though I'm part of the Sangha. I live here. Right. So life has been quite magical, increasing in the amount of magic and beauty for me in the last couple of years. I lived in Seattle a couple of times during the last 10 years or so, which was very important because of the connection to nature. But about close to 2 years ago.
Your work was up in Seattle.
Yeah,
right.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
LinkedIn?
No, before then. It was design consulting. I'm a designer. I work on computer software interaction design. So I was having a couple different jobs up there. But opportunity with LinkedIn came along that has to do with my background in China and the knowledge of the Chinese language and culture. So the work is to bring a platform like LinkedIn to China, which I actually really believe in because I believe in abundance. And I believe the world is already abundant, but there's a distribution problem everywhere. Things like food or jobs, you know, foundational to people's lives. Because, for example, in China, the last year was the worst year in history to graduate ever. Graduate students cannot find jobs. Yeah, there are abundant jobs, but there's a mismatch. There's a gap of understanding. There's a gap of skills and so on. Yet this is a situation that's an infrastructure problem. It's not an individual problem. These young people are very bright and capable if they are simply being matched with the right opportunities. So I do believe in something like LinkedIn being a platform to provide that structure so that people are better connected, which would fundamentally change these young people's lives. And the world belongs to the young professionals of places like China, India, and Brazil, and so on. And and also with economic opportunity eventually comes with other opportunities in life, you know, whether it's political freedom of speech and humanity and so on. I think it's the ocean, right? The ocean creates what's above it, right? And we simply need to understand that the ocean of abundance is there. And so my work, the reason why I very much care about my work is that it plays a small role in that, but I believe it's in the right trajectory toward the future in terms of the macro trends of the world to help people move across international boundaries and for the young people to discover a future that, especially in China, you know, what I talked about my childhood, there weren't such opportunities at all. People were assigned work, which may be for life. So what does it mean to have freedom? How do you find what's right for you? How do you even have the awareness that what's right for you? So I feel that I can do a small thing in that way that creates value in the world in the long run. I also have found that I do some work with teenagers in rural China, American students, to take them to understand global citizenship. And in the process of being an unfamiliar environment and meeting with obstacles and challenges of not speaking the language, living with a family that is, you know, in a whole different culture, that they understand themselves and know their role in a group as leaders. So in that way, I've also found that it's very fulfilling to help people grow and to facilitate their growth. It happens just like my own healing, quite magically and serendipitously. Yet it is very real. You know, these students can come from a 4 or 6 week program and have a whole different take on life. And so that's another kind of work I do, which has also overlapped with my professional work in some way.
You,
so
you take them on tours in,
mm-hmm.
China?
Mm-hmm.
In China?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. In remote China, villages.
Your last
and
trip
cities.
In China, you did that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This time was with educators. So the understanding is that teachers can then share the same, right, to their students. So a little further reach. So that's also a work I think is quite meaningful. I started living here at Jikoji in May, in early May, and it was also quite serendipitous, and I didn't think I could make the commute and so on. And thank you, Doug. And I think for me that was a slightly pivotal point when I said something about not being sure if I can wake up for 6 a.m. Zazen.
What did
that allowing my Doug said something about like the way I laughed about it, that I think there's probably just a human connection about the challenges that this place means. Yeah, there's a sangha of people sharing the same challenges. That we're all quite human in our own ways. We're, you know, peculiar people. So and indeed, I still have those challenges of waking up for 6 a.m. Zazen. Yeah, I'm so very grateful for Jikoji. It has been such an interesting place to be part of a sangha and have a connection with people. Like, I, you know, deeply care about you guys. But this is, I would say, like, for the first two-thirds of my life, I didn't know what it meant to be connected to people. So this, for me, is really, like, what is behind these new eyes? You know, who is this? And so it's fascinating to discover this in this process of relating here, relating to everybody that comes.
That's such a... So thank you, Ying, for being here.
Thank you.
For me, it's, as maybe you know, it's a very unique.
Thank you.
And an addition to white guys, white sensibility that stirs it all up and adds a lot of intrigue. But you said something that was just now, it's really intriguing to me. You said for the first two-thirds in your life, you didn't know what it was like to be connected to people. And to my naive mind, China, as to me, I assume is like a group, and people are everywhere, and so that's a kind of an unusual thing to say for me.
I do have something to say about this.
I
thank
you,
Todd. I think partly why, like I was mentioning earlier, that people don't hear me talk that much because. And I have this very Chinese way of rushing about here, even here, being efficient, getting things done, but not necessarily connecting to talk. Because I think in places like China, often you show a kind of connection through doing things, through action, through taking care of what needs to be done, right? Through, you know, wiping the kitchen table, little things like that.
Pragmatic. Practical, pragmatic.
Right, through service, right? The five love languages, one of them is service. I think that is very Asian in some way. But I realize this is my part of my own learning that's still happening, that I need to slow down. And I need to, you know, I need to see what other people need from me to connect, right, to connect together. Which sometimes is not necessarily through my own way of efficiency, but through talking. There's a process of talking, which I think can be quite cultural. You know, some people talk just to talk, and not just to get
to get
something
done.
Right. At work too, I spend a lot of time thinking about culture and how we can connect more deeply culturally, because there's very subtle assumptions that we have that even though we can be very conscious of the diversity and differences and so on, still there's layers of understanding that can be better, but you don't get to that understanding until there is some connection, right, in order to work deeper. And our brain, the right side of our brain, have instinctive responses to things that we're not used to, which sometimes initially can be a kind of rejection or judgment or assumption. And it's human to do that, which is perfectly fine. But what I've learned is to check my assumptions, is always to ask in some way, which, you know, it takes time to get to know people. mm-hmm. and to get to know a group and to figure out one's place there and across different cultures there's additional hurdles. But what I've learned is to take pleasure in that journey, in that discovery. There's always something more to learn about one another. There's something more, always more to see. It's kind of illuminating, right?
Mm.
Well, I know you from the work setting a little bit more than your personal life and outside. But at work, you're always so level-headed, even in very frustrating situations. Just wondering, how do you deal with all of these type of different situations where you might see people and they might be doing annoying things, mm-hmm. or you might just think something's unfair? Kind of how mm-hmm. does all your Zen teachings help you with dealing with all that stuff?
Thanks. So I want to share with you another quote that helped me a lot, which is from Amelia Earhart. And it is, the price that life exacts for granting peace is courage. So what are you asking? I feel like is partly related to how am I at peace, right? There are lots of situations at work and in general, and life isn't always fair. So, and still I struggle with that. I struggle knowing how much to do, how much I need to do something and change something. And I think in general I do quite a bit. I am actually quite leaning toward action rather than, you know, wait and see and observe, much more so than I used to be. And I can take peace in knowing that I've done what is meaningful to me in that moment, which may not be enough. And I never know how things are actually going to turn out, right? Often the situation has a way of resolving itself too, without me actually influencing it. Or sometimes I can influence it just a little bit, and then it sort of goes in a whole other direction without going toward the initial, what I can see as an impasse or some chaotic situation. But by simply knowing that I am not shying away because I'm fearful, that I've looked at it, that I've felt it, that I've chosen an action if it feels right, or if I've chosen inaction if that feels right, then I can be at peace. It also comes from having gone through situations where I, again, impasses, that I didn't know what to do, and I went through a lot of stress and tried everything, yet nothing was working. Having experience like that is also useful, very useful, because then I know what kind of situation I can handle, how much I can help others in that situation, which helps me as well. And knowing that in essentially crazy situations, I can still be good and helpful, and ultimately more doors opened because I decided to close one, that makes me trust the greater situation. So there's not necessarily a solution to everything, but I can know that I'm constantly learning, and that I can be at peace with all that.
I do have a question.
Sure.
when I was younger, I remember somebody telling me that some people didn't talk just to talk. Like, they wouldn't speak if they didn't have something to say. And I just remember, my mind was so blown by that. And then now as I've gotten older, I, wonder how people who are really efficient in the way they speak, how they feel. Like, for instance, how do you feel? I feel like Americans have a tendency to just talk. Just maybe, babble a bit. Like, how do you feel when you're around people that just talk? And they're not really saying anything. They just like to talk.
That's a good question. I am still dealing with that. Yeah.
Especially when Marshall McLuhan said that language, said that, who's the language guy?
The senator? Hayakawa?
He said that language is sometimes a social lubricant.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't matter what's being said.
Yeah.
What matters is the connection, the meeting of one person with another one.
Yeah.
The content.
That's right.
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yes, that is very
just the meeting. So sometimes we have to just go blah. Just to meet another one.
That's
just
right.
To meet someone else.
That's so true.
Sometimes not.
That is very helpful, and but you know, sometimes I still have a little bit of a struggle when there's something that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So the balance of it can be challenging. I think a lot of that is cultural, but I think it is. I have realized that's often a gesture to connect,
mm-hmm.
rather than the actual content of the words.
Content.
I mean, really, in our for life, the content is not that important.
Mm-hmm.
What's more important is energy, right? Which energy I mentioned is a synonym to me with love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that always, is that sense of connection is always coming from love?
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's five different languages of love, for some people it's touch, for other people it's, you know, service, for other people it's gratitude or compliments, etc. So for me, I also realize that people, and in psychology, one way to call this is people make a bid for connection. They can take any kind of form. It can be wiping the kitchen table. It can be a compliment. It can be a hug. It can be a look, right? So I try to acknowledge the bid, and I try to acknowledge the person. And also, you know, even at work, sometimes you have to say no. I mean, one has to say no, but you can say yes to the larger situation, and you can say yes to the person, even if you're saying no to their particular request or to the content. So for me, being inclined, or basically I feel like I feel happy, and therefore I'm offering bits for connection, and I'm receiving bits for connection,
mm-hmm.
and that is a very different thing from my childhood.
Mm-hmm. So you appreciate people when they make any kind of bid.
I do,
yeah.
I do,
yeah.
I do. I think I can appreciate that more.
Yeah.
But I do.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, clearly I would be much more isolated like I was in my childhood if people weren't kind to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I have, in my travels, for example, you know, you meet so many strangers, and if it were not for their kindness, right, our experience traveling would be so different.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned, but I can see, like myself, my tendency is also to be that kind, right, when I meet a stranger. So so yes, absolutely, this is compassion, this is love, this is loving action.
Well, it's time. Do you have something to say?
So, it's kind of funny, but clearly though, the connection, if you will, here is not so much in talking.
Mm-hmm.
You don't live here. I'm kidding. No, I hear
you. It's
I'm joking.
I can take it. Right? So, I mean, that is something you can talk. We have for ad nauseum talk about it.
Uh-huh.
But actually, it doesn't really kind of doesn't really. I mean, Doug told me a year ago, and get through finishing a sitting session, and he says, "Oh, it's really nice sitting next to you."
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean,
and that's in a way why we come here.
Yeah,
is the connection that isn't about. As you say, the social lubricant, it's deeper in a way.
For sure, for sure. And people who show up here, you know, this is all, it's right that they're here, right?
Mm.
That they should be here at this moment. So yeah, I often have the sense of deep gratitude when you see someone, especially in a setting like this. It's like, wow, you're here too, you know? But that can go for any kind of situation, right? You know, it's like...
I'm not so sure about that. I think it, that's what makes this special and mysterious, partly, far-reaching and quite ancient, is that it is a practice that deals in silence and but yet the connection with other people, of Sangha, as opposed to the Three Jewels, is of utmost importance. And I don't know if you can... I haven't found it as... I suppose, as we say, we take the practice out of this room, and as I practice more, I become more... I can hear this actually transpire in other situations, if you will. I can feel it more. But it's a lot of agitation, if you will, or disturbance on the water. And if without this type of practice, I'm not sure if I could hear it or feel it as maybe. But that's what a great practice does, is connect in a very more ancient, I don't know, more...
But in places that are agitated or noisy, one could also open the door to that as well.
Yeah, especially with this type of practice, you can you can hear it, you can feel it, and but not so easy. You know, just by itself, being in a rock and roll concert or something, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot at work, which is very fast-paced and can be quite stressful. But I've learned that, you know, I mentioned the title of that book, Nothing Changes Until You Do, right? I've found, actually just within the last year, plus 8 months at LinkedIn, that by being different myself, I change people around me, or I influence the situation. So more and more I have conversations like this at work, which kind of baffles the mind in some way, yet it was, you know, until I don't have the fear of like being vulnerable and being in that space myself, those conversations would not happen. So I would say any kind of situation, we have the responsibility to take our experience 100% responsible for it, right? To take ownership of it, to know that we have the ability to influence the energy there, which is sometimes means being okay with the way things are, for sure, as well, you know. But overall, I don't believe this place is in that sense special. I think any place is special, and so are people. And that, you know, I have amazing connection, sometimes with strangers, and I see that actually with people. You know, you cannot know anything about each other, but people sometimes have a interesting connection that later reveals to be quite meaningful. Right? I'm sure we all have experience of this. So why is that, right? But how do you allow that? Rather than saying, okay, this is work, these are just work relationships, and you know, the conversation stays with work, stays with problem solving, stays with being efficient. Can I change myself? And I'm still doing that, like I mentioned, like rather than being focused on efficiency and getting some things done, how do I hear this person? How do I hear where I am? How do I communicate in a way that allows enough of myself to be seen for them to connect with? And we are the material that we work with, but we is also not just this, what you say, skin bag.
You said, what do you think, skin bag? Is that what you said?
No, what he calls skin bag.
I can take it.
Jonathan?
Lunchtime.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
Anybody here?
Okay.